There's a fantastic book that was written a number of years ago called God Is Not One, written by a man named Stephen Prothero, who is the professor, or was, I don't know if he still is, the professor of religion at Boston University. And essentially, this book, God Is Not One, was comparing the eight major world religions, and it was attempting to debunk this idea that, well, all religions are basically the same, right? You may have heard that adage that, or even that example, you know, there's like a mountain, and every religion is just like a different path up the same mountain. They're basically the same thing, and they're all identical, right? And so Stephen, who is not a Christian, wrote a book saying that could not be more wrong. The different religions and worldviews are not identical. They are not the same. There may be similar things in specific religions, but the whole book was essentially saying it is a false idea to say, well, all religion is the same. In his book, this is one of the quotes that he writes. It says, describing the different religions, he says, experience is central in Taoism and Buddhism. Hinduism and Judaism emphasize the narrative dimension. The ethical dimension is crucial in Confucianism. The Islamic and Yoruba traditions are to a great extent about ritual. And doctrine is particularly important to Christians. The world's religious rivals are clearly related, but they're more like second cousins than identical twins. They do not teach the same doctrines, they do not perform the same rituals, and they do not share the same goals. And basically, the rest of his book is he just writes about the eight major world religions of the day, talking about how do they seek to answer questions that all human beings are asking. And we would call these worldview questions, big questions of life. It was interesting, Billy Graham, before he died in an interview, someone asked him, like, this is a man, if you don't know, Billy Graham traveled around the world to hundreds of countries, and he preached to millions of people, and he interacted with hundreds of different cultures and religions. And so this interviewer asked, like, can you say, like, is there a commonality between all human beings? And he said, yeah, there's four things that all human beings that I've met, no matter which country you're born in, no matter which religion you claim, there's four major things. Number one, you're concerned about the meaning and purpose of life. Number two, you are fearful of death. Number three, you're lonely. And number four, you have an unexplained sense of guilt and you don't know how to deal with it. Those are what I'm talking about, like big worldview questions. Where did we come from? What is the origin of humanity? Like, how did we get here? What is mankind's problem in life? Like, you look around the world and listen, everyone is asking, what is our main problem? How do we fix mankind's problem? What is my purpose in life? What happens after you die? And every worldview or major religion is essentially seeking to answer those questions, those same exact questions that Billy Graham says every single person he met has those exact same questions. What happens after you die? Why am I here? Where did I come from? Some people have presented a caricature of Christianity that Christianity provides really weak answers to those worldview questions, right? And oftentimes Christianity is presented as, well, it's just a fairy tale. It's a book of ridiculous stories. And Christianity is almost like a crutch for weak people who can't just accept the facts of life. And maybe you've even believed that or you've heard that. Like, Christianity just doesn't have any good answers. But actually, the more that I have studied over the years, different worldviews and different religions, I have come to realize that Christianity actually makes the most sense out of all of those massive worldview questions. Like in the marketplace of ideas and in the marketplace of worldviews and religions, Christianity actually is the one that makes the most logical sense amidst all the other ones. Our text today, the reason I bring all this up is our text today is a very interesting passage of scripture where Paul is in Athens and he essentially goes toe-to-toe with the main philosophies of the day, the main worldviews of the day, and he has an opportunity to preach the gospel to a room full of philosophers. And the amazing part is that Paul, through the power of the Spirit, actually convinces some of these high-thinking philosophers of the day to abandon their worldviews and become followers of Jesus, which is quite astounding. So we want to look at Acts chapter 17, verses 16 to 34, and we'll basically look at it in four different chunks. We're going to look at the preacher, we're going to look at the audience, we're going to look at the message, and then finally the response. That's how we'll kind of frame up today's message. So number one, the preacher. This is what it says in verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. So let me remind you why Paul is in Athens. If you weren't here last week, Paul and Silas and Timothy were in two cities which were north of Athens called Thessalonica and Berea. And essentially, Paul has been driven out of those cities. There was a group of Jews who started riots and caused all sorts of problems for Paul. And so we ended last week's passage that Paul basically escaped Berea and he traveled 300 miles to Athens. And now Paul is alone in the city of Athens. Verse 15 last week says that Paul has now sent word to Silas and Timothy, who had stayed behind in Berea. And he basically said, hey, come join me in Athens, but our text today, he's there by himself. He's waiting for his traveling companions to show up. And we're told that Paul is in this city called Athens. Now, if you know anything, like if you in high school, and I'm assuming you did, you took like ancient civilizations, you learned about the Greek Empire, and Athens was the pride of the Greek Empire. But in Paul's day and age, Athens as a city was in a period of decline. The glory of, you know, politics and commerce in Athens had long faded away. But Athens was still a center for culture and for education, for rich philosophical debate. There were several universities in Athens, and there was this long heritage that Athens was kind of this culture hub and this educational hub, and where you would learn all sorts of philosophy. So for instance, if you know the names Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, these men all lived in Athens and all taught in Athens. So it was kind of this like intellectual hub of the ancient world. We're going to get there in a moment, but even verse 21 of our passage says that all Athenians would spend their time in nothing except exchanging new ideas, right? This is what the city was about. Let's debate our philosophies, and how do you feel about this? And let me do a lecture about this. It was very well educated. So this is where Paul finds himself, and we're told in verse 16 that as he's waiting and presumably walking around the city, his spirit is provoked within him. The word provoked literally just means he was angry or irritated. There was something in Paul that was making his spirit angry and irritated. It was stirred up within him. Now, I don't think, because this word doesn't mean like an outburst of anger, that Paul, you know, all of a sudden lost his cool and just yelled and caused a huge scene. That's not what it means. It just means that as Paul is walking around Athens, there's this brewing anger in his spirit. And we're told why. It says because he saw that the city was full of idols. This is, again, another interesting word in the Greek language. The word full here is katadolos. It's used only here in the entire Bible. It's only used one time. And it means a few different things. The word katadolos, full of idols, means saturated or smothered or swamped or submerged. So notice, Paul's walking around the city. His spirit is angry because he sees Athens drowning in idolatry. That's what the word means. It's just covered. Every square inch of Athens is full of idolatry, and so he is disturbed. Now, this is not, like, Luke's not exaggerating here as he writes, oh, it was drowning in idolatry. Like, literally, even one of the Athens' own poets wrote, it is easier to find a god than a man in Athens. Like, literally, every street corner, every marketplace was full of idols and temples and false gods. There were numerous pagan temples in Athens. They worshipped Athena. They worshipped Roma. They worshipped Augustus. At the temple of Athena, there was a gold and ivory statue of Athena that was so large, and Athena in that carving was pictured holding a spear. This statue was so large that the point of the spear could be seen from 40 miles away. Like, so again, sometimes I think we have this idea of the ancient world, oh, they worshiped idols that were like this big. No, like, think massive statues of their false gods that you could see like 40 miles, like almost to Dawson. You could see, is that the glittering tip of the spear of Athena? That's how big it was. They worshipped Apollo, Jupiter, Venus, Mercury, Bacchus, Neptune, Diana, all the gods of Olympus, so Zeus and Poseidon, like drowning in false worship. And so no wonder Paul, as he walks around the city and sees idol after idol after idol after idol and temple after temple, that his spirit is angry at all of the false worship that he sees in this city. And so what does Paul do then? Well, he gets to work. As he waits for Silas and Timothy, he begins to preach in the synagogue to the Jews and the God-fearers, like he often does. But then he also begins to go to the marketplace every day, and he would just speak to whoever happened to be there. Okay, secondly, who is the audience as Paul begins to preach in the marketplace? Verse 18, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also, conversed with him. And some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting, for you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Luke doesn't give us any of Paul's interactions in the synagogue, but as Paul is preaching in the marketplace, we're told who his audience became, and we're introduced to two types of philosophers, Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Now, I'm not assuming that you know what Epicurean and Stoic philosophy is about, so let me share with you. Epicureanism, this type of philosophy, it believed that pleasure is the sole intrinsic goal of your life, is just to be happy and to seek pleasure. Now, it's a little bit different. Some of you may know about hedonism, which is essentially like just unchained pleasure. It doesn't matter if you hurt people. Do whatever you want to have pleasure. Epicureanism was a little bit different because they said, well, you should avoid excesses, but you should just seek tranquility and freedom and pleasure in life. Epicurean philosophers believed that everything that happened in the universe was just chance, There was no governing force. Everything that happened was just an accident. They believed that there was nothing after death. And Epicurean philosophy taught that if gods did exist, they were remote and not involved in the slightest in human beings' lives. Do you want to know what the modern equivalent of Epicureanism is? Because I've never met someone who's like, oh yes, I have ascribed to Epicurean philosophy, but do you know what the modern equivalent in our day and age is? Atheism. Epicureanism is essentially functional atheism. There's nothing after death. There are no gods. Everything happens by chance. Just live a good life and seek to be happy. That's essentially atheism. In our day and age, if you listen to any atheist, they will say the same thing. There are no gods involved. Nothing happens after you die. Just be a good person and have fun and be happy. Now, what is Stoicism? Stoicism is a little bit differently, Stoic philosophy said that everything is God. And they would say, if human beings, in each one of you, there's this spark of the divinity inside of you that you have to discover. They called this God that was just in everything, they called this God universal reason, or in Greek, they called him the Logos, which if you know, in John 1, Jesus is the Logos. Now, they're not worshiping Jesus, but they're saying, yes, there's this reason, there's this word that just dwells in everyone, and we're all part of the divine. They would say, opposed to Epicureanism, where everything's by chance, Stoics would say, nothing is by chance. Everything is by the will of God or the gods. And the goal in Stoicism is that you would be free from intense emotion, that you would be unmoved by joy or grief. This is where we get the word stoic from, right? If you're like, my father was very stoic. What do you mean? He showed no emotions. That was kind of the idea of this philosophy. Don't just be unmoved by joy or grief. Develop self-control and fortitude. And Stoics actually believed in a very light version of reincarnation. They believed that, you know, every 100 or 1,000 years, the universe would just kind of restart and we would all be reborn and we would have another try at it. Do you know what the modern day version of Stoicism is? Again, I've never heard someone that's like, I hold to Stoic philosophy, but this is the New Age movement. There's a force in the universe. There's a God in all of us. You have to unlock the divine spark in you. And how do you do that? Well, you just get rid of your emotions and you tap into the energy and you empty your mind and you meditate and then you become one with the universe. That's exactly what they believed. So listen, you know the Bible when it says there's nothing new under the sun? Literally, 2,000 years later, there are people who hold to the exact same worldviews. It's just called something different. So these are the people that Paul's interacting with in the marketplace, Epicurean philosophers and Stoic philosophers, people that have vastly different worldviews than the Christian worldview. Here's what some of them began to say as they listened to Paul, verse 18. What does this babbler wish to say? We, in the last 2 weeks, have learned some really great first century insults, right? Last week, you market loungers. I've been calling my kids that all week. You dirty market loungers. Here's another one. The word babbler literally translated is one who picks at seeds. Paul, you're just a little seed picker. Isn't that? Oh man, ouch. You can use that this week. But here's where the idea comes from. What they're saying is you're someone who picks at ideas, like how a chicken pecks seeds and then spits them out. So what are they saying? It's like, Paul, this babbler, this seed picker is just going along and he's picking at all these ideas. And what they're essentially saying is he doesn't have any ideas of his own. He's an undisciplined plagiarist. He's just this seed picker. Now others, though, some are insulting Paul. And others say, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities or foreign gods is what they're saying. Now, why would they think that? Well, Luke tells us because Paul was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So what does that mean? It means that some of the philosophers thought that Paul was talking about two gods. He's speaking about these foreign gods that we've never heard of. Jesus and Anastasis, which is resurrection. So interesting, because Jesus in obviously is a masculine Greek word, and resurrection is a feminine Greek word. And so some of the philosophers seemingly are going, is this guy talking about two new gods that we've never heard of? Jesus and Anastasis, like resurrection, what is he talking about? So ultimately, what do? They invite Paul to the Areopagus to present his ideas. Now you need to know the Areopagus was a council of philosophers in Athens who their job, they were responsible for religion and education in the city. The Areopagus were the ones who decided who was allowed to teach and who wasn't allowed to teach. All new ideas were brought to them. Now, we're not sure how big this council was, but if Athens was a large city, it was a pretty big council. So Paul, listen, it's not hostile that Paul's invited. So remember, other times, like in Philippi and in Thessalonica, the Christians are dragged in front of the council or dragged in front of the magistrates because they're in trouble, and sometimes they're beaten and thrown in jail. This is not the case. The Epicurean and Stoic philosophers say, Paul, will you come to the Areopagus? Will you come to our council meeting and tell us more about this new idea that you're preaching? This is a pretty huge moment for Paul. Like, let me remind you, on Paul's first and second missionary journeys, the vast difference of the people that Paul was able to preach to. Paul preached to Jews who were very religious, who were devout, who feared God, who believed the Old Testament was the scriptures. He preached to those type of people. Paul preached to Roman governors on the island of Cyprus. He preached to uneducated pagans in Lystra, people that when he preached, they started worshiping him because they thought he was a god. So like literally Lystra was viewed as very uneducated, very primitive. And now he's been invited, hey, will you come to the elite council of all of the brightest philosophical minds in Athens? Like Paul, the Lord just opens doors for him to speak to all different types of people. So we've never seen Paul in this situation before. His audience now is philosophers. So what is the message that Paul shares then? Verse 22. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you." So notice how Paul begins his message. Let me remind you, Paul's spirit is angry within him because of all the idolatry. But notice what Paul doesn't do. He doesn't stand in the midst of these pagan philosophers and say, "You guys are a bunch of morons." He doesn't say, "How dare you worship idols?" And he doesn't just get angry with them. What does he do? He actually compliments them and finds some common ground between them. He says, "Men of Athens, I can see that you are very religious." And that word means pious or superstitious even. He says, I've noticed as I've been here that you are very religious. And then he gives an example. You even have an altar to an unknown god. And so there's actually been evidence found in Athens of they would set up an idol and then they would just put a plaque or something in front of it that said, "To the unknown god." So think about how silly that is in a way, because their city is literally drowning in idols and in temples, and yet they'll set up one more to say, just in case we missed one. Just in case. And okay, well, what's this god's name? We don't know, but we'll just put "To the unknown god" to cover all of our bases. So Paul uses that as this jumping off point. He says, listen, let me tell you, there is a god that you don't know. And can I tell you about him? So the altar, you have to understand, Paul's not saying that their altar to the unknown God, that was proper worship of Yahweh or Jesus. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying, listen, even in you Athenians, there's this feeling that you're missing one of the gods, that you're not worshiping. We just have to make an idol to some unknown God. And Paul says, in a way, you're actually right. There is a God that you don't know. And let me actually reveal who this God is to you. And so what Paul does in the remainder of this talk that we have is he gives them four basic truths about who this God is that they don't know. Four basic truths. So first, he reveals the greatness of God by telling them that this God is the creator. So verse 24, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. So this answers, right? We're talking about worldview questions. This answers, where did we come from? How did everything get here? Where did human beings come from? And so Paul says, there's a God you don't know. And first off, he's the creator. He's the one, he's the Lord who made the world and everything in it. And this God doesn't live in temples made by human beings. Basically what he's saying is, listen, your temple to Athena and to Augustus and to all of these things, like the true God doesn't actually live in these temples that you think. He's the one that made everything, including you. So this God is the creator. Secondly, Paul talks about this God's goodness, that he is the provider and sustainer for humanity. Verse 25, he says, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Not only is this God that the Athenians don't know, not only is he the creator, but actually he's the provider. He gives mankind everything, life and breath and everything that human beings need. I love that Paul says, like, he's not served by human hands, because that was the view of all of this false worship. We have to serve our gods, and we have to bring sacrifices and food to them to please them and to serve them. And God says, actually, do you know the real God isn't served by human? He needs nothing from us, but rather he's the one that provides everything for us. So he's the creator, he's the provider. Thirdly, Paul talks about his sovereign reign. This God is the ruler over all. Verse 26, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. So, like, notice what Paul's doing. He's just revealing more about who this God is, the true God that the Athenians don't know. He's the ruler. God made from Adam every nation, we're told. This would really rub the Greeks the wrong way, because the Greeks prided themselves in saying, we're better than all the other nations, and we're better than all the other ethnicities and all the other types of people. Greeks were created a little bit differently, a little bit better. And so Paul says, actually, this true God made from one person all mankind. And this God is the one that allots certain times and periods and boundaries of where people live and what nations and the borders of. So notice, what does that mean? It means God's ultimately the one in control. He's determining what happens and where you live and what country you live in and the borders of that country. And here's why God is sovereignly reigning, verse 27, that people would seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. This actually, the way it's worded is it's meant to for us to picture someone groping around in the darkness, but not knowing how to find God. So I don't know if you've ever been in a room and then the lights are turned off and it's completely pitch black and you're like feeling around for the doorknob to get out, right? And you're going along the wall and then you're trying to, oh, okay, I think I feel the hinges of the door. That's kind of what Paul is saying, that God created human beings and he determines their time and boundaries. And it's like this idea of human beings trying to find God, but they just can't quite do it. And then Paul quotes two of their own philosophers in his gospel presentation. In verse 28, he says, "In him we live and move and have our being." This is a quote from Epimenides, who was a philosopher that wrote in 600 BC, 600 years before Paul is now preaching in the Areopagus. He quotes one of their philosophers. And then the second quote, "For we are indeed his offspring," comes from a poem called Phenomena by Aratus. And Aratus lived somewhere between 315 and 240 BC. So Paul, notice how brilliant this is. He's like, listen, guys, there's a God who created everything. He provides for you. He's ruling over and he wants you to find him. And then Paul says, it's like your own philosopher said. I'll just quote them. Right? So Paul is brilliant because they're going, oh, you're right, Epimenides and Aratus said that. Those are guys that we believe. So Paul then says that God rules and reigns and that all people are made in his image. That's what he means by offspring. That we are created in the image of God. We are God's image bearers. And he ends that verse by saying, essentially, how then could human beings created in the image of God turn around and create idols that we worship that are made in our image? He's like, it doesn't make any sense that we would create things from our own imagination to then worship. No, we are the ones created in God's image. God's not created in our image. And then lastly, Paul is, he's continuing to reveal things about this God, the fact that God is gracious, that he is our Savior. Verse 30, "The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." So Paul ends by saying, this God that's not only creator, provider, sustainer, ruler, he's actually our Savior. He's gracious towards us. He was gracious in the past. That's what Paul means when he says that the times of ignorance God overlooks. What he means is that throughout human history, God hasn't just poured out his full wrath on human beings, even though we deserved it. God was patient and long-suffering, and he overlooked that because he had a plan of redemption in mind. But now, Paul says, after the death and resurrection of Jesus, God commands all people everywhere to repent because there's a day coming that has been fixed by God where God will judge the world, and how God judges the world is by a man that he's appointed. And that's Jesus. Jesus has the right to judge, but because Paul says we have assurance that this Jesus will return and judge us. Why? Because God raised him from the dead. You know what's really fascinating is that there's some scholars, as I was studying, who say Paul really dropped the ball here, which is fascinating. They actually critique Paul's sermon and they go, this was a fail. Because he wasn't clear about who Jesus is. He didn't present any scriptures to back up his claims. He quoted pagan philosophers. And there's quite a few scholars that say, this just seems like a swing and a miss for Paul. But you have to understand what Paul's doing here. Do you know why he didn't quote any scriptures to back up? Because Epicurean and Stoic philosophers could care less about the Old Testament. So why would you bother? Hey, do you know what the prophet Isaiah said? They're like, we don't care about the prophet Isaiah. So Paul, actually, this is a home run of a message. Because Paul is interacting with these philosophers exactly where they're at. So it wouldn't make any sense to convince them that Jesus is the Messiah. They didn't believe in a Messiah. So let's go back to creation. Let's kind of confront your worldview and your philosophy that you believe in, Paul's saying, by me presenting the actual true worldview. And you have to understand that what we have here is clearly not everything Paul said. Because like you can read Luke's record of his sermon in like 45 seconds. I'm pretty sure Paul spoke for a lot longer than that. But Luke basically, hey, let me summarize everything that Paul said. It's quite an amazing message. Now, fourthly, what was the response? Verse 32, now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. But others said, we will hear you again about this. So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them. So notice, I think we've seen this literally every time the gospel is presented, there is a varying degree of response. There's three responses here. Some people mocked. Some people said, man, that's interesting. I need to hear more. And some people believed. Now, why would people mock? Let's look at each of these responses. Why would people mock? We're told that they mocked because of the resurrection. The reason being is that the resurrection, the idea of a bodily resurrection, was completely incompatible with Greek philosophy because Greeks wanted to get rid of their bodies. The physical is bad. And you're saying, wait, the judge of the world who's going to return and judge us has a physical resurrected body? And they would laugh at that. Literally, the word mocked means to like sneer or to laugh at. So Paul, it's like Paul ends his talk. You know, God, he's given assurance to all of us by raising Jesus from the dead. And they all go, okay, Paul. Because in their worldview, you don't want to be raised from the dead because your body is bad and you want to get rid of it. Even their god Apollo, one of their gods, was quoted as saying, and now Apollo didn't really say this because Apollo's not real, but he's quoted, Apollo said, once a man dies and the earth drinks his blood, there is no resurrection. So that was their philosophy. Why on earth would you want to be raised from the dead? Your body is bad. So Paul ends with the truth of the resurrection of Jesus, and some of them go, okay, this is ridiculous. Now, some needed more. Some were like, man, I got to hear more about this, Paul. Now, I don't know if you've ever met someone like that, but I have. When you share the truth about the Bible or about Christianity, they don't necessarily right away go, yes, I believe. But I've had conversations with people that literally, it's almost the exact same wording where they go, man, that's interesting. Can I meet with you again? I have so many more questions. That's what some of these philosophers are saying to Paul. Man, we want to hear you talk again. I'm not mocking it, but I don't quite believe it yet because I just have so many questions. And then the last response is that some actually believe in the gospel of Jesus. We're told that one of them is Dionysius, who is one of the council members. That's what it means when he's an Areopagite. He's one of the council members. So listen, one of the men who decides the education and the religion of Athens becomes a follower of Jesus. That's massive. And then we're told there's a woman named Damaris, and there's other people with them that become followers of Jesus. So the response seems to be always the same. The apostles faithfully share the gospel, and then God does what only God can do. He opens some people's hearts. Some people, he sparks more questions and curiosity and eagerness in them, and then some, he just leaves them alone for the time being. So this passage is just such an encouraging glimpse into how Paul preached the gospel to different types of people. But as we close and just think of application, I think this should encourage us in two ways. First, I think reading about how Paul interacted in Athens with these philosophers should make us eager to learn what other people believe. Like, listen, if you're a follower of Jesus, you need to learn about other worldviews. Paul clearly knew his stuff, right? Paul is quoting their own philosophers and saying, actually, your own philosophers are proving my point. Now, listen, I know that some of you, because I've chatted with you, have grown up with this idea that you were discouraged from ever learning about any other kind of worldview or religion because there was this fear. Well, if you start to learn about these other things, what if you get blinded and then you fall for it and then you leave your Christianity behind? And I get that. I even had a conversation this week with someone that was like, no, you are not allowed to ever learn about Islam or Buddhism or Jehovah's Witness or Mormon because we're just scared that it'll deceive you. But listen, that is the exact opposite approach we should have. As followers of Jesus, don't you want to know what your neighbors and loved ones and coworkers believe so that you can be wise in how you present the gospel to them? Because notice, Paul doesn't just go in guns blazing, you're all pagans, repent. He doesn't do that. Why? Because he knows what they believe. So we must be eager to learn. I remember this really hit home for me when I was a youth pastor in Maple Ridge, and our youth group had like 100 kids in it. And oftentimes, early on, I would hear, I'm in high school, and I have friends that are atheists, I have friends that are Buddhists, I have friends that are Muslims, I have friends that are Mormons, I have friends that are Jehovah's Witnesses, and I have no idea how to talk to them because I have no idea what they actually believe. So for instance, their Mormon friends would come up and say, yeah, I believe Jesus is the Son of God as well. And they would go, oh, so wait, you believe the same thing as me? Oh yeah, for sure. And they don't, by the way. So we did like a 10-week series in youth where every week we taught them a different religion. And there were parents who were like, this is wrong. Do not teach my kids about what other religions believe. You're going to confuse them. I'm afraid that they're not going to be Christians anymore. And I said, do you not want your kids to know how to give an answer for the hope that they have in them? And it was massively well received because these kids were going, oh, finally I know what makes my friend tick. I know what they believe. Now I can actually witness to them and I can engage with them where they're at. So you should be eager. Like if your neighbor comes and says, I'm an atheist, you should be eager to learn, what do atheists actually believe? Because I want to actually be able to present the gospel in such a way that hopefully makes them go, ah, I believe what you believe, or at the very least makes them say, I got to hear about this more. So we should be eager to learn. Secondly, I think this passage shows us that you and I can have confidence in the biblical Christian worldview. For a few reasons. Notice that Paul's not dragged in front of these philosophers and he goes, I don't know what to say. Christianity can't really go toe-to-toe with your philosophies. Like, you have to know, the Epicurean and Stoic philosophies, those were the two main worldviews of the day. And Paul just goes in with confidence and he battles head-to-head with them. So listen, you just need to hear. If you're a follower of Jesus and you've heard, Christianity doesn't actually provide good answers, it's just a crutch, it's a fairy tale, it's a bunch of made-up stories, you need to hear that is a caricature of people who don't know what they're talking about. Christianity is actually the worldview that makes the most sense of the world, and it actually plainly and with reason and logic answers all of those worldview questions. Where did we come from? What is my purpose in life? What happens after you die? What is mankind's problem? How do we fix it? Christianity actually can, in the marketplace of all the other ideas, it stands toe to toe and it gives good answers. So listen, when you engage with people of other worldviews, you don't have to go, well, I don't know, just believe, have faith. No, you can actually say, listen, your worldview is lacking. It can't answer the questions that my worldview can answer. And to have confidence, not arrogance, but confidence to go, listen, like, look at Paul. It's like whatever situation he's in, because of the Spirit of God, he just walks in with confidence and he presents the gospel. And in each situation we've seen, sure, some mock. So you'll present the gospel to your atheist neighbor and he'll mock you. Okay. But by the grace of God, some believe. Every single time the gospel is presented, so far in the book of Acts, people believe. So if I could encourage you as your pastor, be eager to learn about what other people believe and then walk in confidence that your worldview can answer humanity's deepest questions that they have. So Jesus, I thank you for your word. This passage is such an encouragement to us because it just shows Paul preaching in a context that we haven't seen yet. We've seen Paul preach to Jewish people and religious people, but for him to go and stand in a council full of philosophers is quite an amazing story. God, I just pray that this passage and Paul's words and the result of him preaching would inspire us to be eager to learn what other people believe. God, I know that all of us in this room probably have neighbors or coworkers or school friends or family members that have a different worldview than we do. And God, I pray that we would be eager to learn about what they believe so that we would be able to share what we believe in a way that would connect with them. And then, God, I pray that we would just have confidence in the gospel. But Paul, it seems like no matter what situation he's thrown into, he is just confident that he is filled with the Spirit and that the gospel is true. And we don't get any sense that as some mocked him, that he was terribly upset about that. Because he just trusted. Like, he knew that the gospel was the truth and that your Spirit was going to work and move in however you saw fit, God. So I pray that we would have the same kind of confidence, that as we learn and study and grow in our knowledge of the gospel, that we would be able to share that with people in ways that connect with where they're at. And God, we're asking that we would see responses like that, that people that we know and love would say, I gotta hear more about this. Can we talk about this again? And that others would believe and that they would turn to you, Jesus. And that even though some may mock, that wouldn't shatter our confidence because the gospel is true. So do that work in each one of our hearts, God. And we just pray all of this in your mighty name. Amen.